As soon as you start making music, we're like, okay, I want to make that record because then I will get this result. I think that's when you're in a dangerous territory. We should ask ourselves when we create, are we giving or are we taking? Like, is this for my own identity crisis or is this me that is giving something to others?
That was Taitua, and this is Nordic Portraits. Taitua is a musician and songwriter hailing from the Faroe Islands, whose 2003 debut album, Poetry and Aeroplanes, paved the way for international success and a host of new fans, including the likes of John Mayer, Amy Mann, and Rufus Wainwright. Since then, he has continued to build a strong reputation for his innovative musicianship, as well as his bold collaborations with fellow musicians, designers, and artists. Last year, he was knighted by the Queen of Denmark for his outstanding contribution to the performing arts. Taitua, welcome to Nordic Portraits.
Thank you.
I wondered if we could start by going back to 2008, where you were approached to be the opening act for Roskilde Festival.
Yeah.
A massive event on the European music calendar and a highly prestigious slot that up until that time had only been reserved for Danish acts.
Mm-hmm.
But they broke with tradition and you found yourself standing in front of some 40, 50,000 people on the orange stage. And I just wondered what you remember of that time and did it feel like a major moment in your career as it was happening?
Yes, I guess it was. But at the same time, we were doing crazy things and it happened at such a time when you thought, of course, that's what we're going to do. But yeah, it was an amazing thing to do. And I myself hadn't been to Roskilde as an audience member. I'd played there one time on a smaller stage some years earlier. So I always wanted to go to Roskilde for real. And then this opportunity was massive. And I decided to also stay in the festival afterwards and hang out and really enjoy it. And it was an incredible moment. I remember just playing the first chord. And then people were applauding and you just taking a chord and then people are like, yay! It was incredible energy there.
Well, I wondered if we go back to the very start, what are your first memories of interacting with music as a child?
Yeah, I have some memories. Well, my dad, he played the organ. Like we had an organ, so he was playing in the church when he was younger. And then as an adult, he would have some books and play sometimes for fun. And I was always drawn to that, to playing, to touching and making sounds. And I remember specifically the first time someone taught me how to hold a chord with three notes in it. And it just, I got goosebumps. It was just, made a strong impact on me. So I always was looking for instruments and I gathered guitars, keyboards and drum machines and all these things. And I had a stereo that could record, had a microphone input and this cassette. So I could make some sounds and I got my uncle's guitar also and my dad's friend. He had a bass under the stairs and then I was allowed to take it home. So I was just always hoarding instruments and learning to play. So it spoke to me obviously from a very early age to communicate in music and to hear music and to feel music.
Is it true also that your father would occasionally put on a cassette tape of the musical recording of his father's funeral?
Yeah, that was also a thing. Like my parents listened to a lot of music. And also on Sundays, you go to visit family and you go to church and eat a Sunday dinner, Sunday roast or whatever. There was always choral singing and also from gathering together. You have to realize that in the Faroes, that when I grew up, no one came to play music there. The only music you could hear is the sort of music you can make yourself, you know, with a guitar and singing together like campfire songs, that whole thing. And in the church and then, of course, in the radio where you hear foreign acts. And of course, I'd maybe seen the occasional show and there was, of course, bands, but it was like cover bands and it wasn't like international in any way. And part of my motivation, I think, has been to be part of that, to want to be where the other musicians are.
So did you have a sense growing up even though, of course, a child's view of the world is normal,
mm-hmm.
did you have a sense that you were growing up quite isolated from the rest of the world?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. But when you're much younger, of course, you don't think about that at all. But as you become a teenager, you definitely feel that. But I think it's also the same feeling as any provincial kid would have. It's the same sense of longing, and that was very strong, yes.
And can you describe, just for those listening who might be unfamiliar with the Faroes, what your home country is like in terms of landscape and the culture?
Well, sometimes I like to describe the Faroes as just the bottom of the ocean that peaks up by accident in the middle of the Atlantic, North Atlantic. It's between Iceland, Scotland, and Norway. And it's just 18 small rocks with grass on it. And and we have our own language there, our own government, our own laws, and our own history, literature, music. But it's all very, very young and very, it's a very intimate place to be. And at the moment, there's 54,000 people, I think, that live there. I grew up, it was about 45. It's grown a lot in the last few years. It's the kind of place where you have like one kind of spider and one radio station. Everything that is in a society is there, but it's just smaller and right there. And it's also a multitasking society in a way. You get people who are good at things, who do many things. There's a lot of empty seats, so people take up the chance to do it. If there's no choir, someone will say, I will make a choir. And now there is a choir. And it leaves a lot of playroom too. If you're creative, you can make things happen, you can engage and you can change things, you can be part of society in a good way. That's, I think, the strength of it, is that it's like a microcosm of the big world, but you actually can engage in it in a healthy way.
Is there a downside as you reflect on the community that you grew up in?
Yeah, for sure. It would be, I guess, similar downsides to, if I compare it to the province, you know, from having racism, conservatism, people who do the same thing for too long without anyone helping them. Those kinds of things I feel like are difficult. But I also feel that now it definitely has opened up a lot of people's perspectives. I think it's massive changes that are going through right now.
It strikes me when you talk about this kind of DIY mentality that even as you describe learning instruments as a child, it's not like you just focused on the guitar or the piano. Did you just see it all as a playground for you and you just wanted to explore music across the board?
Well, I think I was mainly just interested in music, but also just in songwriting. I think songwriting has always been my driving force. I love playing instruments and writing for instruments and all this stuff, but it's mainly the storytelling aspect has been my way in a way. And it has to do with what I mentioned earlier with these communal songs. I think that what happens when people sing the same thing together is the most beautiful thing. You know, I'd much rather hear that than everyone chatting in a bar, you know, like I think when we can get together and make a sound together, it's that place I'm trying to be in all the time. I think it's when the world is perfect for me.
So do you feel you actually connect with people on a more authentic level when you're able to play music together versus perhaps conversationally on a, dare I say, superficial level if you were to meet someone?
Actually, yes, absolutely. Like if I'm in a party or something and you're chatting to people, shouting, whatever, if we start playing music at, you know, 3 a.m, I'm much more, okay, there you are. Now I see who you are. I feel like I can get to know people quite well when they express themselves on an instrument, when they make sounds or like, I don't know. I like to see people like that because often we just say shit, you know?
Yeah. Has there ever been a period in your life where you haven't been able to play music regularly or exercise that creative muscle for one reason or another? And what does that do to you as a person?
I think I always make music. I'm always surrounding myself with music. I can't think of maybe when I was like redoing my house, I couldn't play as much music as I wanted to. And I guess that made me very depressed, but I think that's also just the restoration vibe. Yeah.
You've lived in London for a period of time and Stockholm, amongst other places, Copenhagen on and off over the years. I wondered what those experiences have taught you about your own sense of what it means to have a home.
Well, I think the ability to be forced to feel at home, to figure out like what's important, like what makes you happy, I think it's very good for us to stretch those muscles to know what's home. I've been super frustrated with living in other countries too. You don't always understand what's going on, why something is funny, or you know, you want to get the real history or the real background to why things are the way they are. And I think it's inspiring when you're confronted with that. You look for those things and you become curious and the world unravels for you. You understand more of the world. But at the same time, it's frustrating to not be certain. And you always want to fly back to your nest in a way. And that's what happened to me from traveling so much and playing in so many different countries. I went back to the Faroes because you realize that, wait a minute, this is the only place I completely understand. And this is me. This is where I'm from. It's not something that I wanted. It's something I was given. You don't ask for it. It's just who you are. And that's how I must root myself or whatever. And that's the healthiest way forward.
Mm. I'm interested, were there role models for you in the Faroes in terms of people who had set out a blueprint for how one could be a successful musician abroad?
Musically, no. There's the one writer, William Heinesen, who is maybe the first artist to get recognition in a way, international recognition. But in the Faroes, it was very much the classic, so what do you really do? And like, you can't be a musician. And I think that my whole career is a rebellion against that. It's to insist that, no, I can make music and I want to make music. And music is a serious thing and a beautiful thing. And it's not something you just do in your spare time. You can be all about music. And in a way, I think that's why I make music also, is to actually fight that.
Has that been rewarding in seeing your own community embrace that or come to terms with that as your career has progressed?
Well, I think there's a lot of people in my generation who have done a similar case of rebellion in, say, if you're a chef or if you are a designer, it's the same thing you're up against. It's changing people's minds and to not be afraid of admitting that actually you don't know and I have to show you. Instead of being angry and saying, you don't understand, you actually have to show it and bring it. And I think that has happened with my generation a lot. Even something like the G Festival is also about changing people's minds and not just going to the disco and listen to a lame playlist and get wasted. There's other ways you can socialize and go out. All those things, I think we wanted to rebel against our own culture in a way.
And probably sounds easy in hindsight, but I'm sure at the time there were challenges early on. Were there moments where you felt discouraged about the fact that you had to go it alone on this journey?
I think my will and my work ethic, I've always been super okay about it and I've accepted that it's not easy. But I think my drive is so strong that I can't be bothered really. Like I know it's tough, but I've grown super accustomed to that. Yeah, people don't get it or whatever. And that's just the way it is. So as long as I keep myself curious and I'm listening and creating, then I'm doing good. And that's what I'm doing. And I'm fine with others not understanding it.
So you never subscribe to this notion that it's just natural ability or intuition over hard work when it comes to the music business?
No, it's absolutely hard work. Yeah, you have to create things and you have to want to create things. And you have to make yourself a situation where it's not frustrating. It has to be fun and dangerous and challenging and everything. So it's a choice, I think. You can choose this and it's not an easy life, but I've chosen it and I'm glad I did.
You talk about curiosity. What keeps you curious?
I think traveling is definitely one thing. I don't know, just life in general. You know, I became a parent some years ago. And you see the world through different eyes in many ways, not only with that, but I just like to experience things, to sense things. I don't think it's so much music that inspires me, actually. I'm more inspired by what happens around me. I like to think that if I got hit on the face, I will probably write more songs than if I hear some record, you know what I mean? I think it comes from where you are and your wish to express yourself is the sort of driving force. And being curious, I think, is a must in a way. You have to investigate. You have to be a nerd maybe is good, you know, to be an introvert, to have a party with what you're doing, you know. You have to, that's what's wonderful with being creative. You can make your own place and thrive there. That's the goal, I think.
Yeah. You mentioned your father playing music and being an influence. What was it like for you then when you relocated with your mother and stepfather to Denmark? Was that disruptive in terms of your own development as a young man at the time, or did it feel quite natural?
No, I think it was the opposite. I think it was like a massive infusion coming from the Faroes. I was at the time, I think 16, 17. And I already had a band on the Faroes and we were super popular. It was one of those things. I didn't feel the need to be famous or whatever. It was going to school, literally. And coming to Holstebro is the biggest music school in Denmark. And they also had this MGK thing, which is a preparation for the conservatory. And that's where all the people from the region were in those classes. And so I quickly figured out that that was where to be. And everyone played jazz music, which is something I'd never really gotten into at all. And that was super inspiring. Also, as a songwriter, to see how you can make a melody with words and some chords, and then you can make a million variations on it. That was super inspiring to see that, wait a minute, it's not about the way this person does that and that or a recording. It's about creating a skeleton that can be played with for the musicians. That's what a good song should do. It should be the starting point for playing music as well as just being a song, you know. That really influenced me a lot and still think a lot like that when I write music. And also in Holstebro, there was a library where they had all these CDs and vinyls that you could borrow. And I just couldn't believe it. It was right before the internet. So I couldn't believe it. Like, I can take this album and that one and this one too. Like, yep, for a whole week. Yep. You know, I couldn't believe it. So I was super inspired actually to come to Holstebro. And there was a lot of musicians my age too who were amazing, much better than I was. And so it was super inspiring.
It's interesting how you took that as an inspiration and not something that could be seen as demotivating. I just imagine that for some people, suddenly leaving the small pond where they were the big fish and arriving in a place where the world opens up, but suddenly on the flip side, they realize that they might not be the only ones. I'm interested in that. Do you put that down to the fact that you just had a really strong sense of self, so you didn't feel in any way threatened by that situation? Are you competitive by nature?
I think, no, not so competitive, no. I think I'm just driven by music, like discovering music, listening to music, and the competitive aspect, yeah, maybe a little bit. You definitely have to have a killer instinct, as it were, if you want to make music and create and to make a living. You have to want to make something better than whatever. Of course, there's that sort of competition.
Yeah. This idea of a song being a malleable form that can be reimagined in different ways, I find that really interesting in the context of your career, because it seems like you're constantly reinterpreting your own songbook. For you, is that just a case of wanting to avoid getting bored with your own material, or rather you actively wanting to evolve these songs based on the audience or context that you find yourself in?
Yeah, well, I think it's both of those things. It's being aware that if I make a song and record it, I want to be able to play it in 30 years, and it has to have that power. Like, it has to be changeable. You have to throw it against the wall and it can't break no matter where you are. It's a way of making sure that the material is good if you can write it and play it in many ways. But it's also just boredom, I think. I get bored if it's doing the same thing all over again. So I try to look for new ways to have fun. And I think that my fans, they like that too. And it's part of who I am, is that I like to try different things. In a way, I'm also trying to fight against this will that people have. They're trying to lock down, saying that this should be played like that, or that's this kind of music, or tighter is that artist, and you're not supposed to do that. I think I'm always trying to rebel against that too, so that I can keep moving and so that I can keep creating. It's important to insist that you are free.
So when you hear the recordings that you made, say, 15 or 20 years ago, does it ever feel like you're listening to a different person because you've evolved so much as an artist since then?
I don't think about it so much like that. Like I sort of like to think of it as when you make a record, then it's the record that has its own life and you were just part of that journey. But yeah, ideally, I just like to see the music as one song that there's an album of that time. Like it reminds me of the time I was in. And I do sort of, you know, you check in, you want to make sure that this still sound good. And because that's really the whole idea is that I want my music to sound great in 100 years too. I want my music to last. I don't play the game of trying to make it super now or trying to be the hippest thing or whatever, but I'm really, really trying to make it sound awesome in 100 years. I know it sounds stupid, but that's really my whole thing.
So I was curious, just as part of this experimentation and reinvention of your sound, you're very much into technology and not necessarily digital technology, but also just doing things in innovative ways, striking instruments in different ways. I saw the palm mute pedal that you were working on recently, and I'm curious, does that inspire songwriting or can that distract from songwriting if it's not put in the right context? I'm just curious with your personality where you said that you can sit and fixate on things for hours on end. Can you become too much of a tone head or does that just inform the creative process so it's not an issue?
I think absolutely it can. And I think it's both, you know, it can both be a driving force and it also can be, well, it should be an ornament or whatever. But I think exactly that is one of the very sort of core things about creativity. And I call it the fascination phase. For instance, if I get a new instrument, a mute pedal, it can be satisfying enough for me to just do that and to discover that and the joy of that. And that is the driving force. But then I think I am creating something that is more of an identity crisis in a way, or that's more just a process where I think it's greater, it's deeper, it's better if it comes from more of a sharing after the insight experience. If I know the thing, then I am entitled to actually show you something. You know what I mean? I try to do that. I don't want because I am learning about how wonderful bass and drums are, that shouldn't be my driving force for making the song. I think the idea, I always try to improve the idea before the execution. Because music is so playful, it's intuitive, and you're always being tempted to play, and you are playing all the time, even when you are composing, it's play, but it's so tempting to just play. Whereas I think if you don't have the other, the tennis court and the tennis player, then one and one is never three, then it's just one dimensional, or I think it's greater to both be curious and to learn and to experiment, but then you also have to step back. I think you have to do all of those things. But I'm not saying that I succeed in this, but that's like my ideal is to go at it that way.
I was interested that more or less directly after you released your successful debut album, you played over 250 shows in 1 year, which is incredible by anyone's
crazy
measurement.
Crazy times.
Yeah, I bet it was. What interested me about that was the fact that you would go from playing a stadium of 15,000 if you were on tour with another artist as a support to maybe playing a very intimate small cafe the very next night. What has that done to you as an artist in terms of the engagement with the audience and understanding that exchange?
Well, I think it's maybe always with me rooted in the material. Like I think about, will this song be a good song here and there and there? Like I try to look at it that way, that I want my music to work everywhere. Also, it's a part of being a musician is to, that's what's crazy about musicians is that they always go to new places and they can sort of feel out a room. Those instincts, I think, are very trained in musicians. You can walk into a venue and you sort of get a feeling for the place and you sort of think, how will the music sound good in here? Or what songs can I play tonight? And those things. And that's like a muscle that you're using a lot when you play music. And I try to just enjoy that part. And I like it when it's not the same. I like the changes. Yeah, one night is different than the other.
How do you know when you're truly connecting with an audience?
I think if you sense that people are listening, that they decide to go on your journey with you, because that's really the point. Like when you're on that stage, you have to accept that you are in the center and you are supposed to show them, you're supposed to give and not take. You're there to change how people think or feel, to inspire people so you can give them something. So when they come home, they have more than when they came. I try to do that. And usually if it's silence, I think is a good indicator, you know, especially if you're playing like big places. If everyone is just talking and having a drink, your message is not coming across. You know, there's many different ways. But in my case, I think it's storytelling. And I want to make my stories and the musical accompaniment enriching or as good as possible. That's what I'm trying to do. And yeah, you can sense that if you're having a good night. But usually it's up to you. Like if you're in shit shape and you're angry, then your music will sound like it.
These values you talk of being generous and giving, has that always been your motive as a musician, or is that something that you've learned along the way?
I think it's something that you realize that you are confronted with. I think in the beginning, when you play music, it's very much also what we talked about earlier, the fascination phase. You can be driven by, oh, I've got a song on the radio, or oh, I have a tour coming up. All these things can motivate you to, yes, I'm doing something cool. But when you go through many processes, you're also faced with this thing, like, I think when you're very good at something, when you have a power, you can manipulate. As soon as you start making music, we're like, okay, I want to make that record because then I will get this result. I think that's when you're in a dangerous territory. Because I think there's also a moral obligation when you're making music. Maybe I'm a little conservative and I believe in total freedom creatively, but I also think that we should ask ourselves when we create, are we giving or are we taking? Like, is this for my own identity crisis, or is this me that is giving something to others? I think it's a sort of a moral place you come to. I know it sounds super falsed, as you say in Danish, but that's kind of where I'm at, is I want to make sure that I'm doing it not just for my own selfish reasons. And that's a struggle, you know, like, because it is completely selfish just to choose music in that way. So I want to make it worth it.
Yeah. Are there any habits or mechanisms that you've employed to make sure that you keep coming at things from a healthy space?
Yeah, I think it's inside. I think it's, I want to make sure that I'm actually not bullshitting, that I'm writing a song about something that I believe in, something I experience, something that I know that others don't, that I think is good to share, or that I've discovered something in the music that I think is contributional or whatever. Yeah, it's very much like that.
Can you try to describe the feeling you have when you're about to embark on recording a new album? How well do you know the outcome at that stage?
Well, I think, well, you're always surprised, I think, but I do think you know what you're going into it with. You know, if you're going to build a house, you know that the outcome is going to be to what you bring and whether you have a plan, and if you don't have all the tools and all this stuff, like you can prepare and think it through, but it's also a completely, I don't know, I saw this comic book once. I think it was, it was like a classical orchestra. And then the conductor or something said, release the penguins. And I always love this image because it reminds me a lot of music, is that you choose that there's going to be penguins in the piece, but you have no idea how they're going to run, but it's still your decision. You know it's going to be incredible, but you don't know exactly how it's going to be. Maybe something like that, I like to prepare for those things, you know, for the recordings. But I think it's more when I'm writing that I don't know always the end journey in a way. I think when I'm finished with writing, I have a pretty good feeling. But then often it marinates for a long time and then it's completely different because, different weather or different year. There's definitely some things that you can do and not do to get a successful result, I feel like, when making records. I only put out records that I'm really proud of that I want to do for a long time. Usually I have made music, like I have two albums now that aren't out that I think will come out, and I'm working on, I like to sort of be ahead so that I'm not just putting out my latest 10 songs. I think that's one of the dangers too. You can often end up in this place where you're just trying to have something to put out, and it's not a very healthy place to be in. So I like to prepare.
But presumably that means that you have a lot of different songs that are at various levels of completion at any given time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, loads.
That must also be really invigorating.
Yeah, it's like your garden, you know, that you're tending. And then you cut something off, or you decide to give something a better place. Or yeah, it's a whole... I have a kind of a crazy Dropbox.
An insight into Taito's mind. Taito, I also wondered, just in that spirit of being a productive artist, how important for you and your process is the ability to collaborate with others?
Well, I collaborate a lot, actually. I think mainly because I'm very much on my own a lot, and I'm not a very social person, actually. Like, I don't mind my own company. Like, I like to just do what I do, but I think that when I collaborate, I try harder and I see things more clearly often. I make better decisions often, and I'm challenged. I think it's good, but it's also just more fun, you know, if you collaborate. So I absolutely have songwriter friends that I write songs with. Over the years, I've had some people that I've continued to work with ever since my first record, and I still find new collaborators. So I'm always kind of doing something with other people as well as working on my own. Like right now, I'm making a record with a band where I'm helping them write music. And I look for those things also to get out of my own process also and to see how other people are doing.
Is there ever a danger with collaboration where you feel like you've lost yourself?
I think depending on what you say yes and no to, I usually just go for the things that I feel like will be rewarding, where I can learn something, where I can have fun. And you know, you can kind of sense those things, you know, like when you meet someone for the first time, you can kind of feel if you like each other or not, you know, that kind of thing. I think those instincts are super true. You can feel if a process, okay, this is going to be a tough one or this is going to be fun. So I usually just try to get myself into situations that I feel like, okay, this can be a fun process and I do have time. And if I don't have time or there's mental space for that, then I will just do something else. But I try to have different collaborations all the time, actually, because I think it's important.
One album where that seems most prevalent is 2013's Story Music, where you had over 70 musicians play on the record, people from the age of 8 to 80 involved.
Yeah, it was a wild project.
Can you just tell me a little bit about what the thinking behind that was
and
how that experience was for you personally?
Sure. It was very much, I think, two things. Me moving back to the Faroes, like more for real. Like I had a house there, but it was at that time when I sort of chose to go back and live. And also my girlfriend, my wife now, we were going through those decisions. And it was a way, like basically Story Music is all Faroese musicians, except for one song where we had a big symphony orchestra where we couldn't actually get everything together. But the whole idea is to make Faroese music. And also this idea that with the Nordic cuisine mentality of why do you import your vegetables? Isn't it better to use what's in your garden? Isn't it more healthy? Also applying that to music, like why can't I make something cool with my neighbor? Why do I have to go and just pay a fancy ensemble in Los Angeles to play strings? It's very much like that. When you make records, you can kind of just pay for shit. You know, you can say, okay, I want to work with this producer and that publicist and da-da-da. And then you just pay and you can make that. And it was a way to try and say, wait a minute, no, there has to be a different way. And also for me to find peace with this thing we were also talking about earlier about how I can be a musician on the Faroes and exist. It was also very much that process that I wanted to convince myself and to go through a process of a successful experience of making music on the Faroes, because I was always remembering how it was unprofessional, how people don't like music, how people don't listen, and all these things. That was my old demons from my teenage years that I also was just trying to shoot those things down and start fresh and to try to have a successful experience. And also another factor was actually also that there was a recording studio a studio block, which was my friend Jonas, who had been traveling with me for years as a sound engineer. He made a studio. So it was also, okay, I have to make a record here. It makes sense.
And despite the reservations you may have had going into it, how do you reflect back on that experience now?
Well, it was fantastic. It was one of the best experiences, I think, in making an album. And also I was experimenting a lot with mundanity, you know, with writing songs with very little spectacular things happening in them, but songs about waiting, songs about fishing and not getting anything, Mondays, turning on the radio, going to buy gasoline, you know, just like really simple things that are Faroese. It's when not so much happens, but you're trying to make an epic thing out of it, you know, that you give names to a rock, you know, like you're always trying to sort of generate a sort of storytelling to make things exciting around you, even though it's you're on a cliff in the North Atlantic. And I was trying to make the music like that and the songs to be like that. And also the spontaneous aspect, which is super Faroese. When if I make plans, say in 4 months, I want you to be in my studio on Thursday at 4 o'clock and I want you to play this piece of music. Can you do that? Then people are like, I don't know, man. Yeah, probably. But and then they cancel the day before because they forgot. That never works really well on the Faroes. But what works super well is spontaneity. If you call someone, say, hey, tomorrow I'm going to have a huge party. Yes, absolutely. Then people like those respond to that much more. What you in Denmark, they call it gevaliebesøg, or I call it gevaliebesøg. This is when you get uninvited guests. And then the fun happens when you didn't plan it. So I was trying to do the same thing in the music. I would call the musicians on the same day sometime and just be like, hey, can you come to the studio? Yes, of course. And we did a lot of those things. We recorded one of the songs, Hard Work. We went to a bar, Circus, and then just asked people, hey, do you guys want to come into the studio and do this thing with us? Yeah, totally. And it was a lot of that kind of thing.
It must be so freeing to be able to do that, particularly having lived in a fairly regimented world outside the Faroes.
Yeah, but in the Faroes, you totally can do that. I don't know if I would do that in Copenhagen, but I think also musically you get super good results when people are just reacting.
One of the projects that you collaborated on that I'm particularly interested in, mostly because it feels on face value out of step with the rest of your oeuvre, is Running Music.
Yeah.
You talk about spontaneity. For me, mm-hmm. that felt a lot like that, having mm-hmm. listened to it. Can you tell me a little bit what the nexus of the idea for that was?
Sure. I think it's... I held, you know, my speech for Mads Bjørn. Mads is an old friend who he opened up for me many, many years ago when we were much younger and we always just stayed friends. Like I always liked him a lot. So one night we were meeting up somewhere and I think I gave him this whole speech about how you should make music that is useful. Music that has a purpose that others can use and not just make it about you and all that stuff. And then he got back to me a while later and said, I've started making this running music. And I think that's brilliant. I thought, you know, I think every musician could try and do that. It's a super good compositional starting point. What's running music? How do you make music for running? And of course, there's a billion playlists and there is perfect running music. You don't really need to. But also as a creative process, it was super fun. We looked a lot at how people run and tempos and then to try and make this music that is changing, but you don't really notice that it's changing, but it's always trying to push you. So you're listening and tiny things happen more and more. You're always driven to keep your pace. I thought it was a brilliant idea. So
yeah. Speaking of brilliant ideas, who was Rafael Santana?
You know Rafael Santana. It's funny, you should say, I was just in London and this guy, Martin Treff, this record producer, he came in with the original Rafael Santana document. He's framed it and it's hanging in his studio. And it's basically just a silly story that I wrote when I lived in London and I took it to the studio and I gave it to them. And I don't know how it came about, but it was just a silly joke about this guy in the music business who, you know, when you hear a song and it has a riff, like say Final Countdown, You know who came up with that riff?
No.
Rafael Santana. You know, he was working in the studio and then he heard them trying to write a song and he said, guys, I have an idea. And then he put the riff in. And then it just gradually sort of spread out in the music industry. Take on Me, what do you think?
Rafael Santana.
Of course. And Smoke on the Water, that was actually his first one because they were just singing Smoke on the Water and then dun, 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 nothing. But he showed them the riff and that's Rafael Santana.
So just a riff for hire.
Yes.
Wow.
Magic sauce.
And have you employed him for any of your music?
I think he's made his way. He's in a bunch of thank yous on records. It's like become a joke. The people write him as a guitarist. And it's so silly. I think it's also my friend. He has put the melody of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He has sort of tricked that into every record he's played on, either in like a bass part or a synth part. It's in all of his records. It's just like a joke. So, maybe it was actually based on that idea that we should just get Rafael Santana into, turn him into a myth.
Talk about playing the long game for a joke there. I tell you. Elsewhere, I've read in the past that you said that Louis Armstrong was your hero, both as a musician and as a person. I'm curious what it is about him that has so influenced you.
Well, I think originally just an emotional appeal. Like when I heard the music, I just could feel it. A friend of mine bought me this box set of early Louis Armstrong catalog. And it was just at the right time of my life, you know, where it just made me happy to listen to it. It was like happy medicine or something. And then also my grandfather, he didn't listen to music except for Louis Armstrong and Mahalia Jackson. He had two cassettes that I noticed that he was sometimes secretly listening to those things. So I always was curious, like, what is this Louis Armstrong? And I think that it reminded him of when he was a sailor. But I love how Louis Armstrong is all about the music, how he, when he plays, you can feel that he wants music to happen, you know, like he's in touch with the very core of it. And also he's had to put up with so much crap going through his history and how he put a smile on and just gave them music instead. And of course he had his opinions and he voiced them too, but mainly he was just all about the music and you can tell how much he loved music.
Yeah.
And I love that.
One of the opinions that you voice quite regularly is to end extreme wealth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about where that comes from and whether that's been a bigger cause that you've been pushing or is it more just a personal mantra that you live by?
I think just both. You know where I saw that thing first time on a record, like The Knife, the Swedish band, it was in some of the artwork and that sentence was just really strong for me. And yeah, I something I believe in. I think that is dangerous. When things become too big, you ruin them. And when things are motivated by just wanting more, then there's something wrong with it. And I think it's one of the greatest dangers in our world is extreme wealth.
Do you think that stems from growing up in the Faroes, where presumably there's a different mentality that comes from a largely subsistent lifestyle?
Maybe, but I think it's also something that, in a weird way, I think you learn through music, or I've learned through music, is, again, like, what is your motivation? What's your drive? Like, why do you do this? It's something you become aware of. And when you feel that someone is doing something for bad reasons, then it's dangerous, then it's bad. It's literally good versus evil. I think music can teach you when something becomes greedy or manipulative, then it loses the music. Then it's just using music. Then it's not being music.
Mm. So would you say that you're also, by extension, suspicious of success?
Maybe a little bit, yeah. I think so.
So that's also possibly governed some of your choices as an artist?
I think so. I think I definitely have a lot of friends who are ruined by it, who stopped hearing the music. But success is also a good thing. But it just is like, what's your motivation? Like, why do you do this? That's really what's important. The music has to be in the front seat.
You mentioned before that you're playing the long game with your art, that you would like it to be assessed over a long period of time. What is the ultimate compliment that someone could pay you, Taitoa, as having experienced your live performance or listened to one of your records? What for you would mean the most?
I don't know. Maybe if they want to go home and write something too, or I don't know. Or they go home and have sex or kiss their partner. I don't know.
Inspiring creation and connection. I like that.
Yeah.
On an entirely different note, you very recently performed for Her Majesty the Queen of Denmark to celebrate her 50-year jubilee.
Mm-hmm.
How was that experience?
Crazy. It's fun, I think, and weird and wonderful. I think that Her Majesty is a beautiful, beautiful person, and I admire her. It's odd in the Faroes. There's the whole Republican thing also, like, we're not Danish, we're Faroese. So I also have been a little bit ambivalent about it. But in reality, I feel at home in Denmark. I'm in many ways a Danish artist too. I live in the Faroes, I'm based there, but Denmark is a huge part of my life and I love Denmark. So I definitely want to respect and represent what Denmark is. It's an honor. But because I'm from the Faroes and the Faroes have to be represented, it's not so many people who get the call, you know, because we're not so many.
I'm sure there's no tokenism there at all. Just as we draw to a close, Taitoa, you've already done so much in your musical career, but where do you feel your curiosity is leading you next?
Well, I think the last couple of years, I've become more interested in recording, like in that process. I have a studio now, which I never had before. And I like that so much that I think that I would like to always have a studio in a way to try and make a space where others also can come. That's something I'm thinking of. That's been a surprising turn of events, I think. Because I always had some sort of home recording, and recording to me has been mostly a sort of execution process where you prepare things and then you go into a studio and you record it and then maybe you take it back, you edit it and you overdub, you can change things. But I've never envisioned a space where you're constantly in the sort of recording environment, and that's been really mind-blowing.
So you've been able to actually merge that into a creative space as well.
Yeah, and that's super inspiring. And it's something that I haven't realized actually until now. And it surprises me that I'm discovering it only now as a possibility. I thought pencil and paper was always the strongest tool, but I'm beginning to see that it's also a sort of pen and paper.
Yeah. Having been through all that you have, if you could give one piece of advice to a young artist from the Faroes, what would it be?
Practice. Don't look for the appreciation immediately. Like, prepare and practice and be curious and say yes and also say no a lot. Well, that was more than one.
have you said no a lot these days? There must be a lot of offers for various projects.
Yeah, I think I do. I only want to do something if I can really do it. So I say no a lot because it can mess up your process a lot. And it's impossible to do everything super well if you don't have enough time. And also, depending on what the motivation is, like what's the purpose of this, I get turned on by certain things and certain things not at all.
Well, it's certainly been fascinating hearing your insights and personal experiences, Taito. I really want to thank you for taking the time to share them with us
today.
Thank
you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Nordic Portraits is a series by me, Ben Catford. The music was composed by Nina Liu and the visual identity by Copenhagen-based studio Frame. To learn more about today's guest and all the others from this season, visit nordicportraits.net. You can also follow us on Instagram and remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes so we can get the word out. Thanks for listening.